Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Dr. Esther Sternberg, founding director, the University of Arizona Institute on Place and Well-Being, and an expert on the science of the mind-body interaction in illness and healing. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Borel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This has been a challenging week here in America, and particularly in Orlando, Florida. The newly worst mass shooting slaughter of civilians was perpetrated a week ago Saturday night at Pulse Nightclub. About 50 people are dead, 53 more wounded. Again, an assault weapon using a high-capacity magazine was the gun of choice, as it usually is in these mass shootings, as it was in San Bernardino, California in December, as it was in Newtown, Connecticut 3.5 years ago at Sandy Hook Elementary School, and so on. The list of these shootings is long and incredibly painful. A community college in Roseburg, Oregon, outside of Portland last October, an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, exactly a year ago, a shooting rampage near UC Santa Barbara, California, 2 years ago, and again at Fort Hood, Texas, a month before, in Washington, D.C., in Santa Monica in 2013, in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, in Aurora, Colorado in 2012, and, of course, right here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, in 2011, and on and on. Some of the perpetrators were radicalized Muslims, like the murderer in Orlando. He was married to a Palestinian woman who knew about the attack in advance, by the way, or in San Bernardino or Fort Hood. Some of the killers were white supremacists, like the murderers in Charleston and Oregon and Wisconsin. Some were simply insane, mentally ill, like the murderers in Newtown or here in Tucson. But they all had one thing in common, access to high-capacity magazines that allowed them to shoot up to 30 bullets from a gun before reloading. I cannot think of any reason an ordinary citizen would find himself or herself in a situation in which he or she needed to shoot a gun that fired 30 bullets before reloading. That is, by definition, not something anyone needs for hunting, unless the goal is to obliterate the animal, not simply kill it and eat it or skin it. 30 bullets rapidly fired without reloading is not needed for self-defense against a robber or rapist or carjacker. That is, nuts. 30 rounds without reloading undoubtedly might be useful in combat on a battlefield. It is insane to allow virtually all members of American society to buy and use such things, including radicalized Muslims, by the way, who have the same access to 30-shot magazines that they can then attach to semi-automatic assault rifles and pistols. There are currently more guns in America, 400 million, than there are people in America, 350 million. Around 100,000 Americans a year get shot. 31,000 of us die annually. As a rabbi, I keep hoping and praying I won't have to think of new words of comfort and consolation to use after the next mass massacre. But things insist on getting worse. How could we continue to do nothing about high-capacity magazines and stricter background checks for sanity after Gabby Giffords was shot? Or after all those innocent kindergarten kids and their teachers were massacred in Connecticut? And now, after a nightclub full of happy revelers were slaughtered in Orlando, will we again fail to act, allow people on the terror watch list to buy 30-shot magazines and assault rifles? Judaism teaches us that every human life is sacred, that we are each created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, and that we each have responsibility for one another. Kol Yisrael Arivim Ze Bazeh. What will it take for us in America to finally learn that this infatuation with placing military weapons, not hunting rifles or handguns, but high-capacity magazines capable of slaughtering 30 people without reloading, attached to assault rifles, placing military weapons in the hands of every person, no matter how radicalized or unstable, is not the way to run a civilized nation. It is, in fact, a recipe for continued mass slaughter. Please, God, this time, give us the courage to do something meaningful and ban high-capacity magazines. At least then the next radicalized Muslim or neo-Nazi or insane person will only be able to kill 10 or 15 people before he is stopped, not 50. I know it's a tough note to begin a radio show with today, but if we can't talk about it, we will never truly do anything about it. And we must. We must. To play us in this morning, a hopeful prayer for peace in the wake of this carnage. Shalom Rav, grant great peace to your people and all the world. From Armon Bizman, Shalom Rav.
Shalom Rav, O Israel, Amcha Tasim Leolam. 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 Ki Ata
That was Armon Bizman singing Shalom Rav, a prayer for peace. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Dr. Esther Sternberg, is the founding director of the University of Arizona Institute on Place and Well-Being and an expert on the science of the mind-body interaction in illness and healing. She'll explain just how our location affects our lives and health when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Dr. Esther Sternberg is an international expert on healing and physical spaces. She has written best-selling popular books, Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being, and The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. and is the founding director of a program that deals with exactly that. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So what got you interested in the whole question of do spaces have healing or damaging properties?
My background is as a rheumatologist, and I'm a physician, and I started doing research at the National Institutes of Health. Well, I started doing it at McGill University a long time ago, but when I was at the National Institutes of Health, I was studying the connection between the brain and the immune system. And in fact, I've been doing that my whole career, the science of the mind-body connection. That's actually why Dr. Andrew Weil and Victoria Mazes recruited me to come out from the National Institutes of Health to Tucson to create a research program for the Center for Integrative Medicine. And going back to close to the beginning, because I was studying the science of the mind-body connection, I wrote a book, my first book, The Balance Within, the Science Connecting Health and Emotions. And in the course of writing that book, I wanted people to feel that they were actually in the places where the discoveries were made, where the scientific discoveries were made, to prove that the brain and the immune system talk to each other, that that communication is essential to health, and when that communication is broken, then you have disease. And through that portion of my career, from 1980 through the late 90s, I and other researchers in this field experienced a lot of pushback from the parent disciplines from which our field had sprung. And I wrote this book, The Balance Within, to ask the question, where has modern science gone wrong? What are the current discoveries that do prove that the brain and the immune system talk to each other, and that fundamentally are the basis of what is now called integrative medicine? And in order to make the readers feel that they were right there and present, I described the places where the studies and the experiments were done. I described the scientists, so the characters of the people who were doing the experiments, and then the experiments. So it was kind of like a stage play. You know, you describe the setting, the character, and then action. And what happened with that first book is that architects read it. And many architects approached me and said, are you an architect? I said, why? And they said, well, because you describe space and place very accurately, as if you're an architect. Well, the reason is that every time I described one of those places, I went back to, for example, Padua, where there was an ancient dissecting amphitheater. I went back to the Montreal Neurological Institute, where Wilder Penfield did his surgeries, and I described the space very accurately. So at that point, the director of research for the American Institute of Architects and the then director of research for the General Services Administration that builds and maintains all federal buildings asked me, when I was at the National Institutes of Health, if I could help them figure out a way to measure the impact of the built environment on human health and well-being. And that was about the year 2000, just after my book came out. And that launched me on this path of working closely with design professionals to bring medical professionals, scientists, together with design professionals to try to understand how different aspects of the physical environment can impact health and well-being.
It's extraordinary how complex and yet clearly interactional, I don't know if that's a word, interactional, how clearly the space interacts with the people who use the space, and we don't tend to think about that so much. We will talk much more in a few minutes when we come back with our guest, Dr. Esther Sternberg of the University of Arizona Institute on Place and Well-Being here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes. The base ingredients, the propylene glycol vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher, USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We now have 4.5 months until we elect a new president of these United States, and so we continue our 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. Hillary Clinton, after resoundingly winning the final 2016 Democratic primary held in the District of Columbia, met with her rival for the presidential nod, Bernie Sanders. Both sides said the meeting was positive. Clinton, the former Secretary of State and Senator, took 79% of the vote in Tuesday's primary, to just 21% for Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont. Media accounts of delegates have for a week assessed that Clinton is the presumptive nominee, although Sanders, the first Jewish candidate to win major nominating contests, and he won a number of them, has yet to concede. The two met privately, each with top aides, for the first time since the launch of the primary season after the polls closed last week. Bernie Sanders appeared to concede that Clinton had effectively won the nomination and it was time to focus on keeping Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, out of the White House. Sanders congratulated Secretary Clinton on the campaign she has run and said he appreciated her strong commitment to stopping Trump in the general election, his campaign said. Remains to be seen what role Sanders will have at the Democratic convention in July, and perhaps what job Hillary Clinton has promised him if she should win the White House. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Boker Tov, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And welcome back from your latest jaunt.
Thank you.
Around the world, the wrong direction. Right. You were in Seoul, Korea, South Korea. Tell us about an incident that took place there.
Yeah, I was in a million places, to be fair, on this trip. I was in Philadelphia for a college graduation. I was in London to change planes. I was in Israel for 10 days. I was in Istanbul to change planes. I was in San Francisco, Seoul, Hong Kong, Bali, back to San Francisco, and finally back home to Tucson. And we were talking off air about questions of identity and tribalism and how we affiliate with others. And just occurred to me a great example of all of this happened while I was sitting in the San Francisco airport getting ready for the 12-hour flight to Seoul. I'm on Facebook, right, on my iPhone, and I see a message from the nephew of one of my oldest and closest friends, a guy named Andy. And Andy says, I'm going to Asia for the first time. Anybody in Seoul this weekend? So I text him back saying, I'm going to be there tomorrow night, you want to meet up for drinks or dinner or something? He said, I'd love to. So Andy's somebody with whom I've had contact over the years. He's early 40s. He's the firstborn child of the much older brother of a good friend. And that whole family is a Kamprad, Wisconsin family. So we have many
types
conservative of affiliations.
Movement ties.
Right. So I get to Korea, we meet up, we have dinner and talks and a great conversation and a couple bottles of wine, and it turns out Andy's new job is with Rotary Club International.
Oh my.
And the Rotarians are having a huge world conference in Seoul that weekend involving 55,000 people. I mean, I just can't imagine the logistics. And then I understood why it was so hard for me to get a hotel reservation.
Because it was the Rotary International Convention in Seoul.
And the only way I got a room at the hotel where I normally stay, which is the Conrad, is by calling them personally and saying, look, I've been there 15 times. You have this guarantee, blah, 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 blah. Let me have a room. And so I paid like twice the normal rate. And it turned out that a lot of Andy's bosses were actually in my hotel. And he was a little leery about coming there. But touch a big hotel, he didn't run into any of them. and we had a great time, but it brought to mind a lot of issues of, you know, who do we feel comfortable with? Right. Who do we consider unsere, you know,
who's
ours?
Who's our people?
Right.
What's our crowd?
We versus they.
Right.
And this is both a Jewish question, it's an American question, it's a political question, it's a key question in Jewish history, and I think it's a timely question given the various reactions to the tragedy in Orlando. I think this spans a lot of the issues we normally talk about.
And I think this will be something we can talk about for a couple of weeks, just looking at sort of how we understand our identity today. Well, thanks, Tom, for a great story. By the way, I was in Rotary Club for a long time.
Really?
So yeah, I was.
I didn't know they let Jews in.
They not only let Jews in, we even had a president of the Tucson Rotary Club who was Jewish. It does happen, even so.
Wow.
Thanks. We'll talk next week, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Bar-El, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So many incredible Israeli singers and performers got their start in the army troops of musicians, choirs, you know, rock and roll groups. A lot of the most famous artists started that way. There's a younger group that captures some of that same, I don't know, A Star Is Born quality of taking younger talent and putting them into performing troops representing the state of Israel. It's the Tzofim, the Israeli Scouts.
Nachon. And you know what? There is a lot of things that are the same with the IDF and the Tzofim, because of course the main goal of the IDF is not singing, but also the Tzofim, it's like the scouts here, like they have like other goals, you know, it's a youth movement and they teach them all kind of skills. But in addition, it's always, you need entertainment. You need to entertain the soldiers, you know.
If it's not entertaining, Bidiuk. Why bother?
So it's the same, the scouts. Like the scouts, it's not just pure entertainment. There is values. They're bringing like Jewish values and solidarity and all kind of, you know, that things, that songs and dancing are bringing people together. That's the idea of Tzofim Friendship Caravan. And it's not that they call Friendship Caravan, because through this Israeli culture and singing and dancing, they are trying to build friendships and bring people together.
Right. So in creating this image of Israel, that Tzofim travel through the United States, I think they go to Canada too, I assume they go other parts of the world as well. They're going to
three
caravans. Yeah. Wow. So they travel all around. They're going to be here in Tucson. They're here in Tucson performing, I think, tomorrow night, Monday night.
Yes.
Tell us about that performance.
Mitsuyan. It's a tradition by now that every year while they're here, they are doing like a day with the camp at the JCC. And then at the night, it's free and open to all.
We've done that at Temple Emmanuel. We've done it at other places
year.
Around the community.
Yes.
Right.
And the idea that, again, we're inviting the whole community. Of course, the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts also invited. And we will have a small meet and greet between 5 to 5:30. And then they will sing in Hebrew, English, some Yiddish. And we'll dance and we'll involve the community for an hour. And then people can buy CDs and T-shirts like every year.
Yeah, they're
year.
A whole performing troupe. You know, it's very interesting. Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, great organization here in America and England and around the world. But I can't imagine their performing troupe being at the level of the Tzofim, who really put on a great show.
Yes, I agree.
Okay. We will look forward to having them. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
I agree that they're great. That's what I agree.
Of course. We'll talk next week. We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Bank. Boker Or. We started talking last week about your recent trip to Israel with the eighth graders from THA.
Right.
A powerful experience. You hadn't been there in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us who go frequently see change regularly and are amazed by it, but not seeing it in 20 years, really dramatic learning opportunity.
Yeah, just tremendous, you know. And also my experience there was different because, you know, like I said before, the first time that I went, it was kind of floor to ceiling, the whole of Israel. And then subsequent trips were really focused in one area, in Jerusalem. So to me, my perspective was kind of Jerusalem as Israel. And I got a much broader taste and feel and experience with our eighth graders this year, because we went to so many places and saw so many things. So we call the trip the Israel Experience, and it truly is experiencing Israel, the range and the variety, the depth, the different places, the different cultures. There are so many subcultures there. It's mind-boggling. And, you know, what I didn't see 20 years ago were things like the light rail that is now present in Jerusalem. You can hop on a train, you know, every 10 minutes and get where you need to go in the city. And they're building one from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. And there's one under construction in Tel Aviv. The way that the infrastructure of the cities has grown is incredible. Going through Haifa was mind-boggling. It's an active port with the massive cranes and the areas for receiving, you know, freight. And I don't, maybe that was there 20 years ago, but it didn't really resonate with me or stick. But now it's this, like, it's this hub, it's the center, there's this vibrancy, and it really feels like here's where a core of industry is in the country. Seeing the way also that Tel Aviv has grown, and the way that the neighborhoods of Jerusalem have developed, and also Caesarea. You know, Caesarea, there was like nothing there, very small, and now there's this city on a mountainside and kind of sloping gently into this beautiful lake. I'm sorry, I said Caesarea, but I meant Tiberias. And just the way that the country feels so established and thriving and growing. You know, when you drive around Tucson and you see construction zones and sites, it's a little sleepy, it's a little annoying. When you go by these things in Israel, they're active. Big machines are moving.
All kinds of cranes.
Yeah,
moving,
you know, workers are just
around,
crawling all over the place, and they're taking it seriously. And there's this sense of permanence and strength that really comes through when you see all these different regions and places thriving and growing and just bustling.
It's an incredible experience and a great learning experience to go back any place, but in particular, go back to Israel and see all these dramatic and remarkable changes. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Chabad house at Harvard challenges the Harvard University oarsmen to a rowing contest, but it soon discovers that the Harvard crew is recording practice times twice as fast as the Chabad crew. So the Chabad captain sends a spy to Harvard to find out why and how they row so fast. A few hours later, the spy returns. "No," says the Chabad captain, "tell us." "Well," says the spy, "they do everything the other way round to us." "Explain," says the captain. "It's simple," says the Chabad spy. "They've got 8 men rowing and 1 man shouting." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout the land and see if it can be captured. The spies take a month and see the whole of Canaan, and they report back to Moses the land is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, eshkol, so large it needs to be carried by two men on a pole, now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's going to be great, but it's not. 10 of the 12 spies next report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say, and numerous. The cities of Canaan fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance, in spite of having God's support. Two spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report saying that with God's help, the land can be taken, but the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, "Why did you take us from slavery only to kill us here at the hands of our enemies?" It's at this point that the decision is made by God. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in just one generation. And so, after a failed, leaderless attempt to invade the land without God's approval or Moses' presence, a disastrous one, the people are then condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, a total of 40 years since they left Egyptian slavery, until a new, young generation can emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a mentality of freedom. It's a great lesson in the process required to cleanse the trauma of failure from the minds of a community. Often, it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or country. It's the generational turn that comes from learning things can be done differently and better, and that freedom is truly a birthright. May we learn that lesson in this generation. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Dr. Esther Sternberg, founding director of the University of Arizona Institute on Place and Well-Being, author of multiple books, and expert on the science of the mind-body interaction and illness and healing, will explain what significance physical location has on health and much more. All when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In New York, Israel's ambassador to the UN was elected chairman of the United Nations Legal Committee, the first time an Israeli has been chosen to head a permanent committee of the world body. Danny Danon received 109 out of 175 votes in the General Assembly to head what is also known as the Sixth Committee, which deals with issues in international law, including global terrorism. Danon was chosen after months of diplomatic wrangling. He said in a Facebook post that Iran, the Palestinians, and other nations tried to stop the appointment and thanked the countries that stood beside Israel in this historic moment. We will not allow dictatorships and anti-Israel countries to harm our standing in the international community, Danon said. Those who tried to block our appointment would be well advised to take note of the jurisdiction of this committee, as they have much to learn about international law. We are a full member of the UN, and any attempt to deny us our legal rights in this organization will be met with uncompromising rejection. Israel joined the United Nations in 1949 after the UN's vote to partition the former British Mandate of Palestine into Jewish and Arab states made Israel the first country ever created by the UN. It only took another 68 years for an Israeli to be allowed to head a permanent committee of the United Nations. A relatively short period compared to how long we waited to come back to Israel in the first place. In other Israel news, a senior Hamas officer from Gaza has defected. Bassam Mahmoud Baraka, who has extensive knowledge of Hamas's underground terror tunnel networks, has been missing for several days and is reported to have fled to Israel by both Palestinian and Israeli media. Baraka, the son of a Muslim religious judge affiliated with Hamas, the terror group, is believed to have given himself up to Israeli soldiers waiting for him at the border, said Palestinian reports. In New York, Congregation Sherit Israel will appeal a federal court ruling last month that stripped its control of the historic Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island. The Manhattan congregation filed notice last week saying it will appeal to the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in an effort to reverse last month's decision concerning its relationship with the 250-year-old historic synagogue in Newport. Sherith Israel and Congregation Yeshuat Israel, which holds regular services at Touro, the oldest synagogue building in the United States, have been at odds since 2012, when Yeshuat Israel tried to sell a valuable set of rimonim bells adorning one of its Torah scrolls, designating the proceeds for building maintenance and support for a rabbi. Sherith Israel challenged the congregation's ownership of the building and its right to sell its contents. Sherith Israel was the initial occupant of the Touro Synagogue, but it relocated to New York in the early 19th century when Newport's Jewish community plummeted in size. At that time, Sherith Israel assumed responsibility for the building, but the congregation has not been actively involved with the Touro Synagogue in decades. In May, U.S. District Court Judge Jack McConnell ruled in favor of Yeshuat Israel, the Newport congregation, and removed Sherith Israel as a trustee. The central issue here is the legacy of some of the earliest Jewish settlers in North America who desired to make Newport a permanent haven for public Jewish worship, McConnell wrote in his decision. A national historic site, Touro Synagogue attracts tens of thousands of visitors every year. It's a beautiful and very historic structure, and I once had the privilege of attending services there. Its fate matters to anyone who cares about Jewish history and heritage. And if you are a rock and roll fan, you know that little guitar riff is the introduction to one of the truly iconic songs, Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, written by guitarist Jimmy Page, right? Well, perhaps it was actually written by a then 17-year-old Jewish kid named Randy Wolfe. His band Spirit was the headliner for whom the new British import Led Zeppelin was opening in a 1968 American tour. 48 years later, a lawsuit's been filed on behalf of Randy Wolfe, alleging that Led Zeppelin stole the famous riff used in Stairway to Heaven from Spirit's song Taurus. Wolfe, who was given his stage name of Randy California by his good friend Jimi Hendrix, died in a tragic accident saving his son's life back on New Year's Day 1997. His estate filed in the federal copyright trial that began last week in L.A., with Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page and singer Robert Plant appearing in court. The high-profile trial is drawing new attention to Randy Wolfe's music. Some consider him among the most underappreciated guitarists of the classic rock era. In 1969, apparently, Jimmy Page asked Randy Wolfe to teach him how to play the intro to Taurus, and Led Zeppelin's members were fans of Spirit and went to see their shows, even after the band's first tour together in 68. I'd say it was a ripoff, Randy Wolfe told Listener magazine in 1997, and the guys made millions of bucks on it and never said thank you, never said can we pay you some money for it. It's kind of a sore point with me. Well, now we'll find out if his estate will collect on the royalties of the most copied guitar riff in rock and roll history. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dr. Esther Sternberg, is the founding director of the University of Arizona Institute on Place and Well-Being, an expert on the science of the mind-body interaction and illness and healing, and particularly the way that place affects healing. We were speaking about sort of the architectural aspect of the way you look at things. Can you talk a little bit about the way that human beings' interaction with place influences healing?
Well, there are many ways in which our interaction with place influences healing, and that's really the focus of the book, Healing Spaces. So the first thing is that place shapes behavior. You know, if you're in a place where you can exercise, where you can run, where you can walk, you're more likely to exercise. If you're confined to a chair, you're less likely to exercise. So that's a principle in the design field, place shapes behavior. But stepping back and asking how different elements of the physical environment could influence that mind-body interaction, it really is what you see and what you hear and what you smell and what you touch and even what you taste and then what you do in a place that can help you heal. And fundamentally, that's sensory neuroscience. It's how is it that what we see can help us heal? Well, there's a whole series of steps that have to happen between what you see, you know, looking out the window, and how that influences your immune system. And that's one aspect of science, figuring out how the different elements of space can affect your healing. The other is proving that, in fact, it does. So it's not a how question, it's a whether question, as in W-H-E-T-H-E-R.
Right.
So there are many studies, starting with Roger Ulrich's famous study published in Science Magazine, the top scientific journal, in 1984, where he showed that patients who were recovering from gallbladder surgery left hospital a day sooner, had needed less pain medication, had fewer negative nurses' notes, so they were in a better mood. Their bed was randomly set beside a window with a view of a grove of trees as opposed to a brick wall. And there are similar studies looking at people who were randomly assigned to apartments in the projects in Chicago with a view of a grove of trees versus a blacktop. And those were looking at psychological outcomes with less aggressive behavior, more interaction with their neighbors, and so on. So there's a wealth of studies showing that a view out a window of a view of nature is associated with improved health outcomes. And the question then becomes, how does that work? And you can take each of these elements, what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you touch, what you do, and break it down into its smallest controllable parts if you're doing a scientific study. So if we look at just what you see, it can be the view itself, so the view of greenery and nature versus a brick wall. It can be the light to which you're exposed to, and we know that full-spectrum sunlight helps improve moods, whether it's in seasonal affective disorder, a form of depression related to long exposure to low light, or in many forms of depression, or in people who don't have depression. So exposure to full-spectrum sunlight is good for your moods. You can do that with every single one of these elements of how you perceive and experience the environment. A lot of those aspects have to do with memory. So in terms of smell and taste, if you smell something that reminds you of childhood, for example, the happy place, the happy time, and this goes for looking at something as well, for hearing music, it reduces the stress response. It induces those anti-pain molecules in the brain, those feel-good molecules, the dopamine reward pathways. So there are positive molecules that are released, positive brain pathways that are activated, and negative ones like the hormonal stress response, the neuronal stress response that are dampened. And all of that is how what you experience around you can help you heal. It's not just looking at the view and some magic ether happens in the body. It's actually that there are changes in the body, in the stress response that is reduced, in the positive emotions that are enhanced, that then allow those molecules and nerve pathways to allow the immune system to do its job to heal.
It's very complicated, but not at all obvious that this isn't something that they've talked to you about when you check into a hospital. Would you like a room with a view of a tree?
Absolutely not, although there is a movement now amongst design professionals to do exactly that and go beyond healthcare design, but applying these principles to all aspects of design. So the president of the American Institute of Architects back in 2009, after hearing me speak about the subject, and I was doing a book signing, told me that I had inspired him to create a program at the American Institute of Architects to bring health into all aspects of design. And so there is a design and health research consortium at the American Institute of Architects. There is a design and health leadership group, of which I was one of the founding members. And certainly there is a tremendous movement to bring these principles into design of hospitals, but also offices, schools, your own home, and so on.
This has been an interesting subject for a long time. People have believed that places had healing qualities, and usually they associated with, I mentioned the water, you know, partly in fun, and I went into it, and it's really cold. But water seems to have some sort of intrinsically healing quality in people's minds. Why is that?
That's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure that I can answer it. It is true that it's universal across cultures, whether it's looking at water, whether it's being in water. You know, maybe in ancient times it was known that you need to wash to get rid of the bacteria. Well, they didn't know there was bacteria, but
no,
cleanliness
but
is important with, for health.
When you think like the Jewish, mikveh is such a central feature of Jewish places all around the world.
That certainly may be part of it. I mean, a lot of these things, I think, were started for health reasons, that somebody must have noticed that there was an association. But again, beyond that, there is something about looking at water, hearing running water, that is very calming. And that speaks to all aspects of nature. There's a whole field of design called biophilia, which means love of nature. And there's a lot of studies that show that the more varied plants, the more greenery there is, whether you're in it, in a forest, whether you're looking at it, it's associated with improved moods and less stress. So there are many, many elements of these kinds of places that contribute to healing. I think the history and the legend is very important. You know, in Tucson, we have our own mini version of Guadalupe, at Tumamoc Hill,
right.
At the base of Tumamoc Hill, there's a shrine to the Virgin Mary. And, people go to that hill to reduce their stress. St. Mary's Carondelet Hospital is right across the way, so the staff use it. People in the neighborhood use it. People from all over Tucson walk that hill for many reasons, but including sort of spiritual experience of climbing to the top of that hill, and the stress reduction. And interestingly, it is and has been a sacred site for 3,500 years. So this is sort of typical of many of these places. Santiago de Compostela is the same. It was an ancient site of where there were prayers, belief that if a woman went to the end, it's called Finisterre, the end of the earth.
Right, the very end of the, on the coast, which it's a, sort of the farthest west you can get.
In Europe, right.
In Europe, right.
The tip of Spain, the farthest west you can get in Europe, and women would go there to pray in the sunrise if they were infertile. And that was ancient. That was thousands of years ago. And then it became a sacred site for the Christians who believed that Santiago had reappeared there from the Holy Land.
St. James,
and,
right.
And so there are layers and layers. It's like an archaeological dig of belief that is often in these actual places. You have to wonder whether there's something about those places that really does resonate, and maybe the reason that people began to feel healed in those spots.
I have to tell you, there was an ancient pilgrimage route, we they think now, that ran not through Santiago de Compostela. They somehow sailed over to England, and it runs all the way to Stonehenge.
Yes, that is
phenomenal.
Correct. Yes, I've talked to archaeologist friends who've told me that
yeah,
Stonehenge
wild,
is another one of these.
Yeah, and it's along the sort of the same, and it ran through Canterbury too, which later, of course, became a pilgrimage site in the Middle Ages. But it was a pilgrimage site in Neolithic times.
Well, and Lourdes is on that
same
trail.
Right on the same path.
Right. So, you know, I experienced my own healing, which I didn't write about in the book. Either books directly, but we did address in a PBS television special that I did called The Science of Healing. And I had gone through a period of extreme stress when my mother was dying of cancer. My father had died of a long illness, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's-like illness. And I developed inflammatory arthritis, which was sort of ironic because I was a rheumatologist who discovered that the brain's stress response is important in susceptibility to inflammatory arthritis. And then 10 years later, I get stress and then I get arthritis. And I had moved into a new house in Washington, D.C. shortly after my mother died. And my neighbors were Greek and they came to the door bringing moussaka and tzatziki and dolmades. And they saw me writing what was to become my first book, and they asked me if I'm a writer, and I said, oh, I don't know, why do you ask? And they said, because we've always wanted a writer to stay at our cottage in Crete. And I said, I'm a writer. And I went with them to Crete, to Lentas, which is a tiny village on the south coast of Crete, which has this history of healing. I did not know that when I went there. It particularly has a history of healing related to water, because there was a fresh water source in the time of Hippocrates. It was that's 500 BC. It was a thriving seaport, which was the first stopping point for coming from Egypt. And what I discovered, first of all, I got better while I was there. It was only about 10 days, and I began to really feel better day by day very quickly. And I discovered above the town that there was a temple to the Greek god of healing, Asclepius. There were these ruins, which the villagers, it's a tiny village, and the villagers just took for granted. They said, oh yeah, there's some, you know, ruins up there. And it was this amazing temple to the Greek god of healing. And so even way back then, the ancients felt something about that place that helped them heal. And part of it was a fresh water source. But part of it, I think, was the calm, the beauty of the Mediterranean, sitting on that slope, looking out. And, you know, I would spend hours up there just, I called it contemplating, because at the time I didn't realize I was meditating. I was in the moment. I was listening to the birds. I was listening to the scratch of the gardener over on the slope, the sheep and the goats and the wind, and it put me in this state of calm.
And it healed you, or helped heal you anyway.
Yes.
I want to thank Dr. Esther Sternberg for a fantastic visit here on Two Jewish. I feel like we just scratched the surface of how this affects everything. We'll have to have you back. If people want to find out more, the best place to go online, esthersternberg.com, estherstenberg.com. Thank you so much, Esther.
Thank you so much.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guests will be the very funny, creative geniuses behind the YouTube sensation Yid Life Crisis, Jamie Ellman and Ellie Battalion, creators of the Yiddish language mini sitcom that has taken the internet by storm. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Yuval Dayan, Bidiyuk Kemo Hayareach, really like the moon. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
בשבילך עד שתחזור להביט בי כמו פעם חלפה הרוח בוא תניח יומך על כתפיי תחוז בידי תספר